Welcome to the Hinckley Institute of Politics. My name is Rebecca, and I will be your host for today's forum. The Hinckley Institute was established in 1965 through the generous bequest of the Nobel Foundation and Robert H. Hinckley. The Institute is dedicated to teaching students respect for practical politics and the principle of citizen involvement in government. The Hinckley Institute offers paid internships for students of all majors here locally, in Washington, D.C., and in 35 countries around the globe. The Institute also offers classes, our nation's only campaign management minor, week-long experiences to Washington, D.C., and $70,000 in academic scholarships. We invite students to go next door to our office or online at hinckley.utah.edu for more information. The title of today's forum is U.S.-Spain Relations. Today's guest is His Excellency Ramón Gil Casares. Ramón has been appointed Ambassador of Spain to the United States, having most recently served as Spain's ambassador to Sudan and South Sudan since 2011. A member of the Spanish Foreign Service since 1982, Ambassador Gil Casares has previously served as an advisor to the Directorate General of Africa at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs. He also served as ambassador to South Africa and as Secretary of the State for Foreign Affairs. In 1996, he was appointed Director of the International Security Department in Prime Minister José Anzar's cabinet, later serving as Secretary of the Foreign Policy Council, formed in 2000, to coordinate the activities of the different ministries and agencies abroad. In addition, he has served as Deputy Director General of Cooperatives at the Spanish Institute for Development Cooperation, and later as Spain's Deputy Consul General of Spain in New York in the early 1990s. Please join me in welcoming our guest.
Thank you very much for the introduction. I feel greatly honored, frankly, to be here at the University of Utah and to be able to address the students and the faculty of this prestigious university. I've just come from a tour around Salt Lake City. I'd never been in Utah before, and I'm really impressed with what you have here. For Spaniards my age, and I will let you guess how old I am, the name of your state, and I was referring to that yesterday with some of your colleagues at BYU, reminds us of two things. One is our first history lessons at school, and the other one is our first mistakes in English pronunciation. You see, when we were studying our, we were in grade 3 or 4, when we were 8 or 10 years old, we studied the history of Spain in the 15th and 16th century and the age of exploration. So we used to go the way history was taught in Spain during those times, trying to memorize names and the places they had discovered. And we went on singing as we read books, the textbooks. Hernán Cortés discovered Mexico. Francisco Pizarro conquered Peru. Ponce de León reached the coast of Florida. And invariably, at a given moment, Francisco Vázquez de Coronado appeared. So we all went, Francisco Vázquez de Coronado reached the territories of what today is the state of Utah. So invariably, of course, the teacher went, Utah. It's pronounced Utah. As you listen to me today, you will see that I've not overcome my pronunciation problems. But there's one thing I want to tell you, and that it's what has been clear in my mind since then, is that Spain, its history, its culture, and its reality cannot be explained or understood without America, North, South, and Central. In the next 20 minutes, and I'll try to make sure I don't go far beyond that, I'm going to try to explain the reality of Spain today and how America is important to us. I will go to our current weaknesses and some of our strengths, since we are where we are today, I'm not going to shy away from the euro crisis, don't worry. But let me start where I left off. Spaniards were the first Europeans to migrate to America, as you know. Some of the values and institutions that shaped this continent were brought by men and women from Spain, and that, allow me to say it, we're proud of. But the bond that was created between Spain and America was not just one way from Europe to this continent, but it was two ways. And just as a way of an example, The spirit of the American Constitution of 1778 was adopted, was, if you allow me the expression, translated into Spanish in the first Carta Magna that we had in our history in 1812. That first constitution, drafted by Spaniards from both sides of the Atlantic, in fact, one of the fathers of that constitution came from New Mexico, embodied that common dream of freedom that we all had. And of course, within that dream of freedom, it was inevitably the elements that led to the process of independence of the Spanish colonies of Latin America. That American-inspired institution of 1812 was also the first of a rich constitutional history in Spain that ended in our current constitution of 1978. And I'm referring to this one because this last charter paved the way for a successful transition in our country, political and economic, that changed the image and the narrative about Spain that existed both in Western Europe and in North America. And I want to refer to that. I spoke with the Spanish community in Salt Lake yesterday, and we spoke about the image of Spain in these days in North America. And I'm going to try to give you some explanations as to what is currently happening. Until those years, after 1978, the beginning of our transition, which I hope some of you are familiar with, Spain had disappeared from center stage of the big European nations in the world. Some of you, and I don't know how much European and Spanish history you study, but some of you probably have not even heard of what was happening in Spain during most of the past 100 years. And I'm going to tell you in a nutshell, it'll be 2 minutes. We started the 20th century recovering from the loss of the last colonies and the defeat of the Spanish-American Wars, the Spanish-American War that you know. During the first 20 years of the 20th century, we had a weak parliamentary democracy that witnessed the assassinations of two prime ministers and a war in the north of Africa, which was finally won after a humiliating and devastating defeat for a public opinion. There followed 5 or 6 years of relative progress in the late 20s under a soft military regime. And then in the midst of the world crisis of 1929, the monarchy was expelled from Spain. A new republic came. That new republic never managed to be stable. And then under the pressure of the new ideals of communism and fascism that reigned in Europe during the 30s, none of the governments of the Republic were strong or inclusive enough to avoid the country being torn into two ideological camps, and that led, as you probably know, to a very cruel civil war between 1936 and 1939. I guess you've read about the war, you've read about the military regime that came thereafter, which was not soft this time around. And this is not the time to elaborate on it, but let me just say that because of that cruelty of the war, the image of Spain as an exceptional nation, and exceptionalism, it was called, of Spain, became the normal image of our country in Western Europe and in North America. There were images, and if you go to the newspapers in America and in Western Europe about Spain during those years, pictures of old women all dressed in black with their scarves. There were young, semi-starving men working the fields of a very poor country. There were tales about very cruel people fighting and killing each other. Ours was a country where even the most beautiful of women, and you'll remember the legend, carry a dagger under the girdle. The problem with these images is that all of a sudden they became romantic and attractive. So they started to multiply. There was literature, sometimes good, that was written about our country in those times. Photographers scrutinized every corner of the nation to get pictures that were also sometimes good about things and histories that were really, quote-unquote, Spanish. During the last years of Franco, in the late 60s, a new economic policy was established, tourism appeared, the country opened to the outside world, and basically that untrue or inaccurate, if you allow me, narrative of what Spain was changed substantially. In 1975, Franco died, and then many in Europe and also in America came to Spain to see if the previous image was true, and we were going back into a civil war. You should have seen historians and specialists in Spain coming and asking, is it true that you are going to accept the communists? Are the communists not going to come back and start a new war? So in a way, they were sort of looking for a good story and a good image. But it so happened that we were pretty normal, and we still are pretty normal. And we didn't go back to what they were expecting to 1936, but we went back to our old traditions, brought, as I tell you, a century before from America, from both sides of the Atlantic, and gave ourselves a constitution based on the very values that Spaniards had agreed on 150 years back. Again, in a nutshell, let me tell you what happened in the years that followed. After the Constitution, Spaniards, led by a king many doubted that could lead the country, undertook a process of reforms, both political and economic, that brought the longest, and I say the longest period of peaceful prosperity in the long history of Spain. In 1992, in our path to normality, we joined NATO. In 1986, we became members of the European Economic Community. Our transition process, all of a sudden, was studied in Central and Eastern Europe and in Latin America as a success story that could be of help for their own processes. As far as the cities go, Madrid took world center stage in 1991 as it hosted the peace conference on the Middle East. And Barcelona, what can I tell you? Many of you will not remember it. You're not old enough. But the Olympics of 1992 were, if you allow me to say it, unbeatable. These were the Summer Olympics, not the Winter Olympics. Spanish investments in Europe and Latin America increased dramatically. Firms like Santander and Telefonica became worldly renowned. They had record-breaking profits year in and year out, and our political and business leaders, such as Felipe González on the left or José María Aznar, my former boss, on the center right, were listened to, something that was unheard of some years back in Spain. And all of a sudden, Spain had become a really modern and trendy nation. The best cooks, they said, were Spanish. Everybody had bought something to wear in Zara. Spanish actors and filmmakers were winning Oscar awards. You had Plácido Domingo, Penélope Cruz, or Antonio Banderas every other day on talk shows in this country with a slightly better accent than mine. And I'm not going to go into sports. Based on this solid democratic state and on sound economic reforms, it seemed that the creativity and imagination of the people of Spain had changed the image of our country, luckily, and we had reclaimed the place that we had lost 150 years back. But then a crisis came, and let me go into the crisis and let me explain to you how it happened. In 1999, the European Union decided to go into an economic and monetary union, and a group of European nations joined in to launch this process. This was the next most important political step in the process of integration of the European Union. And I'm interested in stressing this. This was a political construction, not just an economic construction. And that is very important to understand what's happening. As it had occurred before in the process of integration of Europe, this step was taken knowing the leaders quite well that not all the necessary institutions or policies for a common currency were in place, and hoping, as it had happened before, then when difficulties would arise or imperfections would appear, then the whole design would be fine-tuned between the member states and Brussels. It was clear, we all knew it, that we didn't have a common fiscal policy. That's very hard to get, and those competences are very hard to yield. The central bank that we had, the European Central Bank, was not properly an institution that could act as a lender of last resort when debt problems were to appear. But again, as with many processes, I tell you in the many steps in the process of integrations, the issue of yielding competences to Brussels. Sovereignty to Brussels is an extremely sensitive issue, and it is seldom done unless the alternative is even worse, and maybe we're in that case right now. So how did this new currency affect Spain, and how did we get into the crisis we're in today? During the first 7 years of the millennium, between 2000, 2001 until 2008, there was substantial growth in Spain due basically to the membership of Europe. This growth generated considerable tax returns, which led to sound public finances with low deficits and even public surpluses for 2 years. Along with the new currency, there came low interests. Spain was still suffering from some of the rigidities in the past, like its labor market. There was relative low productivity compared with other nations in Europe. There was scarce investment in innovation and development, and therefore we had a lack of competitiveness compared with other nations in the euro area, especially the most important ones. But as I tell you, cheap money was flowing in, and the need for structural reforms was not perceived as urgent. Growth during those years was based basically on an excessive development of construction and, of course, on near full employment. As you know, construction is a labor-intensive type of industry, so we almost reached full employment. And there you have the recipe: full employment, excessive construction, low interest rates, expectations of unending prosperity, and that led, and you've been through it also, to cheap mortgage loans by the banks, and as a consequence, to a spiraling process of private indebtedness and to an undesirable exposition of some of our financial institutions to what had already become evidently a property bubble. At the same time, the sound public finances that I spoke before prompted an unexpected increase in government spending to the most ridiculous of things, and I'll explain it to you afterwards if you want, at the regional and local level, that reached its peak in 2009. By then, 2009, the financial crisis that had started in this country had reached Europe. It had affected countries in a very different ways. In the case of Spain, the property bubble burst, construction stopped, unemployment went from 8% in 2009 to the current 23% of the workforce. People without jobs people without jobs were unable to pay back their loans, and so some of the banks, some of the financial institutions were in serious risks of going bankrupt. And of course, the flow of cheap money from the rest of the euro area eventually stopped. In this situation, tax returns started to get lower, but the government had to face an increase in social spending given the rise of unemployment. Moreover, the state had to intervene to avoid the collapse of some banks. If you add to that some ill-advised policies that were taken by the previous governments in order to try to create more jobs based on investments, non-productive investments, you will understand why public accounts went from a 1.2 surplus in 2007 to almost a 9% deficit between 2008. That is a record-breaking 10 points in 2 years. And what started as a private debt crisis turned all of a sudden into a public debt one. In these types of situations, and I guess many of you know, what government do, apart from undertaking the necessary fiscal and structural reforms, is resort to flexible monetary policies that keep the flow of money coming into the economy, basically the recipe that has somehow been done in this country. But of course, in the case of Spain, that was impossible. We didn't have our own currency. We shared the euro. The crisis had affected in a different way the different countries of the euro area, and there was not a common recipe as to how to respond. The European Central Bank was not a full-fledged central bank with the capacity to react as a lender of land resort for situations like the ones in Spain. And that affected, on the one hand, the image of the euro. All of a sudden, the new currency that had been very popular for many years was seen in risk of survival. Markets started to bet against it. And the capacity of some of the countries to finance themselves in the markets became more and more complicated until they had to ask for help. And you know the example of many, and I'm not going to go into that. For the last part of 2010, and especially after the elections in November 2011 in Spain, an intensive agenda of economic reform and budgetary measures was put in place in my country. Practically no economic sector has been left untouched. There have been reforms in the labor market, which was the more important one, public sector, transportation, justice, education, energy, you name it. Budgetary adjustments and measures to reduce public deficit have also been put into place. Their aim was to create a more competitive and more dynamic economy, hoping that the structural institution failures of the euro would also be addressed. These measures, of course, have created hardships to many Spanish citizens, and this, as these reforms always do, and as a consequence, and you might have seen it on the newspapers and on the media in general, there has been violence in the streets of some of our large cities. Against this background, some are wondering whether the accomplishment of Spain in these past 35 years were just a byproduct of a buoyant economy boosted by our entry in the European Union and in the euro. And some are asking, again, whether we are doomed to become the negative exception of Europe. Let me assure you that that is not going to happen for two sets of reasons. The first one is basically European. If there's one thing Europe is good at, is to turn a crisis into an opportunity. And there's no way, this is no way, the euro is not going to succeed, because it would be bad for all the members of the euro. Yes, we're in difficult times, but progress, although slow, is being made. Many countries are reforming, as we did, and the institutions are working, slowly, but working. And I'd prepared something else to tell you, but only the day before yesterday, it was made public that a new instrument had been presented by the European Central Bank and by the European Commission to help Spain's financial problems. It is a combination of a precautionary liquidity line and the commitment of the European Central Bank to purchase Spanish debts in the secondary market when the spread of the Spanish bond with the German bond reached a certain level considered intolerable. So there's this precautionary liquidity line. Spain doesn't have to use it. It's there in case it's needed. If the markets react and we can go to the markets and sell our debt at a reasonable rate, we won't use it. But the markets know that we're going to get financing from the European institutions, and so they'll be more easily open to Spain. The details and the conditions of this proposal are still not known. We don't know what's going to come out of it. We still haven't asked for them until they tell us exactly what it is. That's what the president of the government said, again, the day before yesterday. But the very fact of its announcement made the stock market in Madrid go up 2.5% during two consecutive days. This is the first step in the process of rebuilding an institutional and policy framework that was needed for the euro. The banking union that's necessary might not be far. The financial union, I'm sure, will take longer, but things are moving. But I said there were two sets of reasons. And the second one is basically that reforms have started to work in Spain. Our gains in productivity and competitiveness and our salary moderation are enabling us to improve our current account balance with the rest of the European Union. Our trade balance with the Eurozone, just the Eurozone, has been positive in 2011, and it's the first time in history. This had never happened before. And in fact, during the first half of this year, 2012, this surplus has multiplied fivefold. I won't play tricks on you. Part is due to the fact that our consumption has been reduced enormously, so we're not buying as much as we used to. But the truth of the matter is that we're exporting more than we're importing, so our trade balances are positive. On the other side, Spanish economies that had opened to the world years ago are now competing in all kinds of markets. Spain is one of the top 10 countries in terms of foreign investments. 50% of all infrastructure concessions around the world are managed by Spanish companies. By way of example, I can tell you that a consortium of 12 Spanish companies is responsible in the Middle East for the most significant infrastructure project in the Arab world, and that is the high-speed railway between Mecca and Medina, a project worth $10 billion. A number of examples can also be taken from the Americas and basically in the Americas. In total, the accumulated investment by Spain in America, north and south, exceeds 160 billion euros, 116 in Latin America, and 44 billion in North America. 260,000 jobs, direct and indirect, are generated by Spanish companies. Only the United States, out of the 700 Spanish firms that are working in your nation, there are 70,000 direct jobs that have been created, and 300,000, they say, they're always difficult to calculate the indirect job, but they say that in around 300,000 have been created in the United States. The United States was the leading recipient of direct Spanish overseas investment in 2008, 2009, and 2010. Important investment by Spanish companies can be found very near in the field of the renewable energy, for example, and some of you might know, a Spanish company, Abengoa, was awarded the construction in Arizona of the largest solar power plant in the world, and partnerships exist currently on technology advanced projects such as the partnership with NASA on the current Curiosity mission to Mars. The best way to prove unambiguously the productive capacity of a country is through this performance of the companies in the global markets. One of the most neglected facts about Spain has been that during the good years, corporates have been actively diversifying their businesses, investing abroad, preparing to enter new markets, and devoting resources to new sectors with high demand potential. And it has been due to these policies that many firms have been able to weather the downturn at home with their overseas investment. Let me just give you an example. Santander, Banco Santander, probably one of the best known banks in Spain and the largest bank in the Eurozone, only has 10% of the profits coming from my country. If you add Brazil, the rest of Latin America, and the U.S., almost 50% of the profits come from those nations. So it's a Spanish firm that basically gets most of its profits from abroad. I'm going to start finishing because I'm spoken for 25 minutes already. I started saying that in 1812, in what was the starting point of the modern era for Spain, America was present. During the first crisis of the late 1890s, there were lots of immigrants that went to, especially to Latin America, but some of them to here, and you can see the records in Ellis Islands if you go, about 70,000 Spaniards that came. In the 1950s, when there was again the crisis in Spain after the war, many Spaniards found home in a new life in America, north and south, and somehow we have been able this time around to survive the crisis thanks to the opportunities and the investments of our companies in this continent. America has become a fundamental part of Spanish life, and I am sure it will continue to be, especially once this crisis is over, and that will not take long, let me tell you. I thank you very, very much.
Going to devote the rest of the time to questions. If you do have a question, please state your name and speak directly into the microphone.
Hi, my name is Amber Anderton. Thank you for coming today. We appreciate your time. Recently, the EU was awarded with the Nobel Peace Prize, and I would like to know, as a member state of the European Union, as a representative of the member state in the European Union, how you feel about that, as well as the benefits and drawbacks of being a member state in the European Union, aside from the financial issue.
As far as the Nobel prize award is concerned, I was surprised. About 99.9% of all Europeans weren't expecting it. I don't know if somebody thought these people need a push, and they gave it to us, and that was probably the reason. Not that the whole project didn't deserve it. I mean, I think it's been exemplary how especially old enemies like Germany and France have managed to turn the page of history towards progress and how we seem to be doing. I think probably the Nobel Prize was deserved. I don't know if it was ever given to a country or to us. It's not an institution. I don't know how would you call the European Union a political construction. So I'm sorry. Do we like it? We like it. Are we enthused about it? Frankly, not, because we didn't expect it, and we don't know. But it's fine. It's nice that they've done it. If it's assigned by the Norwegians to say we're not members of the European Union, as you know, to say, okay, they're here to stay, fine, we appreciate it. We are here to stay, okay? The euro is not going to blow up into pieces, and basically because nobody would win. Just think if we were, the poorer countries in the euro, like Spain, would have our currency devalued by 20-30%, and Germany, theirs revalued by 15-20%, but then all the market of the German products is basically the euro area, so they would find it impossible to export again. We're going to both. There's all sort of theories about the euro. One of them is the coronation theory. So this is crowning the end of the process. Another one is the locomotive. This is the institution that's going to pull the European Union into definite integration. And there's another one that it's called something like in the brink type of. So we're always in the brink, and when we're about to fall down the cliff, then we come up with a solution such as the one yesterday. It will not solve them, but we'll keep on solving it as crises come. Being a member of the euro area, I think the easiest way to answer that question is nobody has asked to leave. Nobody. Are there drawbacks? There are drawbacks because when you apply to come in, you have to adjust to a series of requirements. Sometimes you have to make reforms that are tough on your people. You have to privatize. You have to reduce some of the sectors that you might have protected by the government because they create lots of jobs, but they're not compatible with some of the common policies, such as the agricultural common policies or the fishery common policies. And I think all in all is a good deal to be a member of the European Union.
Yes, I was just wondering, with the financial and economic difficulties that the country's facing, what's being done to attempt to secure more foreign investment to help aid that recovery?
Okay. Of course, I cannot go into the details because many of the details I probably don't know either. But the first big reform that we made, and we were speaking about it yesterday, was the labor reform. As you know, during the times of Franco, what he did very wisely was to get the trade unions inside, within the system. We had what we call a vertical trade union system. So workers were overprotected. There was no way you can fire without having to go through two big expenses any work, and the labor market is very rigid. When the transition came, since everybody was on board on the transition and there had to be trade-offs, one of the trade-offs from the right to the left was not to touch very much this rigid labor market, which was in favor of the worker, in favor of the trade unions. Especially the way they negotiated. And during the rest of the transition, nobody wanted to touch that because that was like a sacred, a key, as we say, of the transition process. Now, when the crisis has come, it was absolutely inevitable to change that. So we've reformed that. We've created a much more flexible labor market. Gone into sectors that were not being profitable, that had lots of state aid, such as energy that has been reformed. The budget has been reformed, and so there are lots of reforms being done. We've reformed some the financial sector, helping some banks to survive, even though it's been very costly. Just as a way of example, and I was speaking yesterday also with some other people about this. What I do in Washington and in New York when I go and try to entice Spanish businessmen and Spanish funds to come and invest in Spain is to them, listen, you're going to find a country that has probably the best infrastructure in Europe, because most of the funds coming from the cohesion policies and the structural policies in the EU was directed towards infrastructure. So we have great highways, great railways. You're going to find a country which has a labor reform already done, a very flexible labor market you're going to find. You're going to find a country that has 22% unemployment, 23% unemployment, even though that is something it has to be talked about. And you have a country with people that are well prepared, that have been working in Spanish companies that are international, and you're going to find very cheap for you to invest. And what they tell you, they used to tell me about a month and a half ago, last time I spoke with one of these groups, is, but are you sure that the euro is going to survive? You say, well, I'm positive the euro is going to survive. So we're not so certain. So if the euro doesn't survive, you're automatically going to be devalued 20-30%, and you're going to be cheaper than today. So that's the image. As soon, again, so Spain, the crisis of Spain was twofold. There was the domestic crisis of our evolution and of our system not good, and a crisis that was derived for being a member of a euro without this whole structure into place. Now, if we manage to get the euro working again, then it will be easier. I think money is going to start flowing in. And the very fact that our stock market in Madrid has gone up two consecutive days is, in principle, a small proof of it.
Okay, thank you very much for the chance given to me. My name is Alit Sudarsana. I'm a political science student here. I believe that the most important issue coming from Spain nowadays is about the economical crisis. My question is, how many years do you think Spain will need to recover from this economical crisis, and how do you find the relationship between Spain and U.S. will help the Spain to recover from this crisis? Thank you.
And the experts say that a big construction bubble that turns into a financial bubble also, that's what happened in Spain. It takes 3 to 4 years, but that also depends on the bubbles. Ours was huge. Ours was huge. Our private indebtedness, because some of the figures dance in my mind, but I think it was something like 170% of our GDP. That was the private debt that, of course, some of it we've had to absorb in the public sector. But they usually say three to five years. We've gone, 2 years and a half into the crisis, so we'll probably have 2 more years to go. But that's anybody's guess. I'm being recorded, which scares me a bit. So if you fail an exam because you say 2.5 years and then it's only 2 months, I'd be glad. But don't put the blame on me, okay? And the U.S. Well, the U.S. As long, and I think it'll be as the market here is open, and they manage to see the opportunities. American investors usually don't care very much about details, the past, the present, and if they see that there are opportunities, they're going to go. How these hedge funds work, and maybe some of you will work in the future. You have a kid, if you allow me your term, a bit older than you, that has finished an MBA in Utah University and is there in New York working for a big firm, and he's looking at opportunities, and he reads 3 days in a row in the Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal, which are the only two papers they read because they don't have the time to read more. They say, okay, this is going well, this seems to be going well. Somebody has jumped in and it seems they're getting profitable, and they go click, and all of a sudden you have a big hedge fund of $2 billion going in, and if one comes and then another one. And at the end, this is the process that Marshall did when he invented the Marshall Plan. I mean, this was a continent that was destroyed. It had the capacity, it had the people, and all it needed was money. And so what happened? It took a while, and it's going to take a while for us to do that, but it'll happen.
Hi, my name is Pamela Portocarrero, and I am a political science and international studies student here at the U. A couple of weeks ago, we had Ambassador Ammann from Germany here talking about the future of the EU. And he mentioned that there's a desire, and maybe in the works, the call to further the political integration of all the member states. Do you think that this move would bring about more unity and better performance of individual country institutions, or do you think this would create a loss of sovereignty, maybe, and they should just stick to the economic integration?
Every time you take a step into integration, you lose sovereignty. Any sovereignty that you lose at the end is political. Even if you lose a small thing in economy, that's something that you're given the power to decide to Brussels or to Frankfurt, if it's the European Central Bank. I think there's the desire to integrate. Sometimes it's hard, and this crisis has had the problem that it's created because it affected us in a different way. It has created some bad feelings between one and the others because we didn't see it. If you saw it from the financial perspective, what you were saying is, okay, these are 5 or 6 countries, and it was the case in Spain, whose public finances were awful. They had all these regional government spending like crazy. Their bankings were not well overseen. And so they lent monies at the subprime rate, and so that has happened. So it's a bit their fault. So they have to reform before we start taking measures from Frankfurt and with the European Central Bank to invest. What do you have on the other side? On the other side, you have people saying, we have a crisis that's probably not of our own only. We joined the euro. We're subject to one rules. At a given point, let me tell you, the only problem with this type of explanation that you give is you seem to put the blame on everybody else. I don't want to put the blame on anybody else. But at a given point, at the beginning of the euro, as I was saying, the interest rates were very low because it was needed for some big political operations that I don't have to talk to you about. And they needed countries in the north low rates. Probably because we were less developed, there were more opportunities in the south, our economies were getting overheated, and we might have needed a bit higher interest rates. But they were kept low. So there was lots of money moving around. The opportunities were in Spain, and most of the money that kept flowing to Spain came from the north. So these were banks in the north that were lending to banks in the south, lend to the consumer to get these mortgage loans. There was a lack of supervision on our side. True, but there was lack of supervision everywhere. And at the end, we're all in the same boat. We can give the explanation. It's true that we have to reform, and maybe these new lines that has been granted to us now and not a year and a half ago is because they've seen the effort of reform. But now they also know that some of our crisis is due because we don't have a monetary policy to work with, and it's because of the euro that we're in. I don't know if that responds to your question or not. Thank you.
My name is Adam Wallace. I'm a student here at the U. Mr. Ambassador, we've talked mostly about economic issues, but if we could switch over to security issues real quick. After the 2004 Madrid train bombing, Spain pulled out of Iraq, and in Afghanistan, the Spanish involvement's been seen as sort of small and restricted by the rules of engagement. And last year, we appreciated the Spanish help in the NATO intervention in Libya. But looking forward at Iran and future crises, can we expect a strong Spanish ally, or what do we see coming from Spain?
You want me to get into Spanish politics, which was something I didn't want to do. I was foreign policy advisor and Secretary of State of President Aznar, was the one who decided to joining the efforts in Iraq. We joined in, of course, in Afghanistan, where our presence is still there, and it's rather significant to a country our side. We have 1,500 soldiers there, shoulder to shoulder with your people, and we're proud of it. The decision taken to withdraw from Iraq was basically taken because of domestic promises that had been made, unfortunately, at a given moment, and not knowing the consequences. I'd rather stop at that than going to criticizing the opposition, the current opposition in my country, as you can understand, but I'm sure you know the history, so I don't have to go into that. That has been an exception. Don't think that is the normality. Not even the left. Listen, as you know, when we had the bombs attacks in 2004, it was 3 days before the elections. I also don't want to get into American politics, but just as a way of an example, look, controversy that has been created here, because at a given point after the death of your ambassador in Libya in Benghazi, the information that came during the first week was different than the one that was confirmed the following weeks. In Spain, the bombs take place on March the 11th. We're having elections scheduled for March the 14th. During 2 days, they're asking the government who did it. Be honest to say, who did it? A week, 6 months before, an ETA, that's the Basque terrorist group, was caught in one of the train stations in Madrid with dynamite to make one of the trains explode. That was exactly what happened 3 months later. All the lines of investigation went towards ETA, and during 2 days we said there was ETA. At one point, a car appears with some pages of the Quran in Alcalá de Henares near Madrid, so there started to be hesitations. I remember, because at the time I was the number two at the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, asking our services, what do we say to our allies? And people telling, and our services, our domestic services, telling us, it's ETA. We know it's ETA. How did they know? I don't know. It all happened that 3 months later, it was not ETA. During those days, people thought we were lying for 2 days. And they were so mad because it was the biggest terrorist attempt in the history of Spain that they thought the government was lying. And they voted against the government and power, against the candidate that was from the same party as the former president, and we lost the elections. It was democratically done. No complaint regarding that. I'm going to that because the Socialist Party went to the elections to lose. They thought they were going to lose a week before this thing happened. So they didn't have the best candidate, and they weren't expecting him to win. And he came, and we came with a very radical agenda, because he had tried to get his votes from our radical left. He had an agenda. I mean, it's respectful, but it was not based on the tradition of the Socialist Party. And so that will never happen again. You won't have it from the center right, the current government. You won't have it from the left. That we will abandon. Let me just for the record say that the issue of Libya was not NATO organized. It was a coalition of the willing, as we usually say. And we're not going to withdraw from Afghanistan until we have to. We're still in Somalia, and we will remain there for many, many years. Our people have trained the Somali military police in Uganda. We're going to go together, and we're speaking about it, and I am doing it personally in whatever has to be done in Mali. Mali is 100 kilometers south of Spain, and you have four different terrorist groups there, at least three, and we're going to be involved in there. We've just signed an agreement with the U.S. This was last month, 2 weeks ago, whereby in one of the naval bases that we have in Spain, in the southern part of Spain, called Rota, four American destroyers are going to, I don't know how the naval term is, going to be parked there for the program of the anti-missile defense of NATO. So, yes, you can count on Spain being a truthful ally.
Are there any other questions? Perfect. Well, please join me in thanking our guests for an excellent and informative forum.